From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Many young African-American filmmakers celebrate the blaxploitation films of the 70s like Shaft and Superfly for creating black screen heroes and opening opportunities for black actors and directors. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from Melvin Van Peebles, Isaac Hayes, and Pam Grier, some of the people behind classic black action films. And we hear from members of the generation of African-American filmmakers who grew up on those action films, Robert Townsend, Keenan Ivory Wayans, and Damon Wayans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Western nations are warning the Bosnian Serbs that any more moves on the safe haven of Garajdan will be met with a substantial and decisive response that might include NATO airstrikes. The measure is short of the UN, or rather U.S. proposal that would use overwhelming airstrikes if the Serbs attacked any of the four remaining safe havens. NATO has used airstrikes before, but has halted them when peacekeepers have been taken hostage. Defense Secretary William Perry says the Allies have agreed that if airstrikes begin and hostages are taken, the bombing can't be stopped.
We all understood that the success of a sustained air campaign depended on it being sustained, and therefore it could not be deterred or interrupted by hostage taking if that were to occur. We cannot let a policy be hostage to the taking of hostages.
British Foreign Secretary Malcolm Rifkin says the Allies have unanimously agreed that the United Nations must continue its mission in Bosnia. Reuters News Service is quoting a senior British official who says European Union mediator Carl Bildt believes he's technically got an agreement with Serbia to recognize Bosnia. Such recognition could lead to the easing of international sanctions against Serbia. Bildt has been meeting with Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic. The French foreign minister earlier told Reuters that a deal had been reached. There are no other details on the report. The Senate today approved a plan to cut $16 billion from what's left of the current federal budget. NPR's Philip Davis has this report.
The bill, which rescinds money already approved for current programs, passed by a vote of 90-7. It took 5 months, including a presidential veto, to pass what Republican sponsors say is just a small down payment on much bigger cuts in the federal budget to come. Opponents said the bulk of the cuts came out of programs helping the poor. But after vetoing the bill in June, President Clinton now supports the plan, along with most Democrats. Democrats got some $700 million in cuts restored to programs the administration favors, like school anti-drug programs and safe drinking water. And along with all the cuts, there's some significant new spending in the bill, too, including $7 billion in disaster relief for California and 37 other states, as well as money to repair the damage done in the Oklahoma City bombing. I'm Philip Davis at the Capitol.
A House Appropriations Committee has voted to let states deny government-financed abortions for poor women who have been raped or are victims of incest. The measure would require states to provide abortions only if needed to save the life of the mother. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 14 points at 4,627. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. A psychiatrist has laid out life details of accused murderer Susan Smith. She faces the death penalty for drowning her two sons. From member station WFAE, Suzanne Stevens reports.
Psychiatric expert Seymour Halleck testified Susan Smith is mentally ill. He told jurors Smith has a history of emotional instability dating back to her father's suicide when she was just six. At 13, Smith herself attempted suicide. At 16, she was sexually abused by her stepfather and made to feel responsible by her family. At 18, she again attempted suicide. Her marriage was rocky and failing in the days leading up to the boy's murder, Halleck testified, and Smith began feeling depressed. She was having several affairs that included her employer and her stepfather. Halleck testified Smith thought about suicide every day in the months leading up to October 25th. The defense is expected to wrap up its case this weekend. For National Public Radio, I'm Suzanne Stevens reporting.
The Clinton administration is in the middle of yet another hearing. The Senate Judiciary Committee is examining charges that federal law enforcement officers engaged in racist conduct. The probe centers on an annual picnic commonly known as the Good Old Boys Roundup. It's a law enforcement gathering in Tennessee. Justice and Treasury Department officials are testifying, along with the heads of the FBI, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. President Clinton has criticized the event and promised to take appropriate action. The governor of California rejects the idea that ending affirmative action will bar minorities from state universities. Pete Wilson says that's just, quote, pure speculation. California State University Board of Regents has voted to end race and gender-based preferences in hiring by the start of next year and in college admissions by the following year. Wilson told several news shows the policies are unfair since they favor groups over individuals. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
How come a couple of cats from Harlem come downtown this morning looking for John Shaft?
Well, they're soul brothers. They came down so I could teach them the handshake.
They find you?
Of course, I wasn't hiding.
If you find out anything, give me a call, huh? I'm still at the 38th precinct.
Right on.
Hey, where the hell are you going, Shaft?
To get laid. Where the hell are you going?
A scene from the 1971 film Shaft, the first of the blaxploitation films. In the 70s, many African Americans criticized these black action films for glamorizing drugs, violence, and sex. But now they're celebrated by many young African American filmmakers for creating black screen heroes and opening up Hollywood's doors to black actors and directors. The Film Forum in New York is in the middle of a blaxploitation festival featuring such films as Shaft, Superfly, Coffee, and Cleopatra Jones. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, we'll hear some of the creators of now classic black action films. The movie that inspired the blaxploitation era was the 1971 independent film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. It was shot on a budget of $500,000 and ended up grossing $10 million. Melvin Van Peebles produced, wrote, directed, and starred in the film. The story was about a black revolutionary on the run after he kills two white cops who brutalized a fellow revolutionary. Melvin is now also known as the father of actor and director Mario Van Peebles. They collaborated on this year's film Panthers about the Black Panthers. I spoke with Melvin Van Peebles in 1990.
Your film, Sweetback, was considered to be the first of the blaxploitation films. What you did was you took the action genre and put it into a black politicized context. And I'd really be interested in hearing what gave you the idea to do that.
My original reason for going into films was that I had gotten tired of seeing blacks portrayed in an image that I didn't agree with. So I wanted to control how I was perceived, and therefore I went into films. Now, you said something very interesting when you said that the film was the first blaxploitation film. It was not really the blaxploitation film. It started blaxploitation, which took out the political content and just kept the action and the winning black person. In fact, the revolutionary aspect of Sweetback was put at a 180-degree turn and became almost an apology for the man. For example, what I mean by that is Sweetback had a political education. This person who was essentially apolitical, as he was running from a situation that he always had avoided, he discovered that all of the lines in the community were controlled by a larger power structure, and that power structure was coming down on him like a ton of bricks. And therefore, what he had avoided, that knowledge that he had avoided, he was confronted with. And rather than acquiesce to that situation, he charged forward. However, what they did afterwards is they took someone like the detectives, who, if you really analyze it very carefully, was always under the thumb of an urban buona. That is, Shaft had the commissioner to report to, even though he was permitted to be slightly freelance, slightly freewheeling, which was the sop that was thrown to the black audience. The Cleopatra Jones series. There, again, you had someone who was working for the government as an undercover agent. In each case, these people became an apology for the system.
Well, you're talking about wanting to make movies that had an image that you believed in. Now, Sweetback was praised by a lot of people for being a black film, you know, made by blacks, starring blacks, set in the black community. On the other hand, it was criticized by many people within the black community for having its hero be the real stud. And some people saw that as perpetuating a stereotype instead of shattering it. And I wonder what you thought of those criticisms and what you think of them now in retrospect.
Well, I thought that Jesus Christ was nothing but a carpenter in his own hometown, and so it really didn't bother me too much. I think that's completely valid, what they said, and I disagree with it 100%. That is, you can take a stereotype, and you don't have to run from it. You can take it to the other side and throw it back a la jiu-jitsu, and use that stereotype as the impetus for your force. You see, I could have taken Sweetback and had him a college professor, but that was not the situation of the people that I wanted to talk to, the large group of people that I wanted to talk to. I took Sweetback from, let's say, one of the lowest possible common denominators in the community, and therefore moved him forward. I didn't move him forward from some elevated period or position in the community from the first place, whereas the people once again left out in the cold. It wasn't somebody that they knew. That's why I felt that the audience reacted so positively, the major audience, much of the intelligentsia or many of the cultural nationalists did not like that move. Well, that is a valid point of view. It doesn't happen to be my own.
There were a couple of weeks when Sweetback outdid Love Story at the box office, which is pretty extraordinary considering it was an independently produced film. How did you independently get that kind of distribution?
Well, I didn't independently get that kind of distribution. What I simply did was make a good movie. Only two theaters in the United States would show it. Two theaters at all would show the movie. And they did so well, then everybody called me. And at that stage of the game, hey, it was their turn in the barrel. I made deals, and the audience went to see it. That's how that happened.
Director Melvin Van Peebles recorded in 1990. The first of the studio blaxploitation films was Shaft, starring Richard Roundtree as a private eye looking for the kidnapped daughter of a Harlem ganglord. The theme from Shaft launched a new sound in action themes and won a 1972 Academy Award for the composer and singer Isaac Hayes. He went on to star in a couple of action films. In the 60s, Isaac Hayes helped shape the sound of Memphis soul music as a songwriter, arranger, producer, and singer for Stax Records. He co-wrote hits for Sam and Dave, Carla Thomas, and Johnny Taylor. I spoke with Isaac Hayes last year. Now, you recorded the theme for the movie Shaft in, I guess it was 1971. How were you asked to do this?
Well, it was a whole concept. Hollywood recognized that they had to look further than they had been looking to get business. I think it was fledgling at the time. It was a bit stagnant. And Melvin Van Peebles had put out a movie called Sweetback's Badass Song. And they said, it might be a market there. If we come up with a concept to have a black leading man, a black director, maybe a black composer, we might hit that market. MGM was the one that pioneered the idea. So we had a meeting out there at MGM with Stax execs, and they asked me to come. And they talked about the concept. And would I do the music? Would I be interested in doing the music? Yeah. I said, I want to act too, man. Have y'all cast for the lead role? Well, I don't know. We'll look into that. But anyway, I think that was a sticking carrot, you know. So, right. So I agreed to do the music. They had already cast Richard Roundtree, which was rightfully so. He's perfect for the part. And I agreed to do the music, and that's how that whole idea came about.
Here's where you really get into orchestrating, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me how you started using that wah wah guitar funk style.
Ha ha. Well, okay, trade secrets. Now, when it was time for me to do the Shaft theme, I said, now, what can I do? They explained the character to me, you know, a relentless character, always on the move, always on the prowl, and you got to get something to denote that for the main theme. I said, now, what can I do? I thought about, if you remember Otis Redding's Trial of Tenderness, I had a hand in that arrangement, too. In the end, Al Jackson was doing some stuff on a hi-hat cymbal. You know, you got the na-na-na, boom, you know. So I thought about that. I said, maybe if I just sustain that particular thing on the hi-hat, that would give you a dramatic effect as something that's relentless. Now, what else can I do? I thought about the guitar lick, and I went and pulled it out, played it, and Charles Pitts, we call him Skip, he played the thing on the wah-wah. I said, hey, play this line. He started it. And I told Willie, the drummer, I said, Willie Hall, I said, give me that hi-hat, man, some 16 notes, you know. And he did that. And it worked.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks?
You're damn right.
Now, there's something I've been hoping to be able to play for you for a long time, and I'm just thrilled I have the opportunity to do it now. I want to play this record for you, and tell me, I figure you've probably heard it, and you could tell me what you think of it. So let's hear an excerpt, and then we'll talk about it.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on. Black private eye, whose mastermind has got him what he wanted. Shaft. Shaft is the man.
Isaac Hayes, you recognize the recording?
Yeah. I produced that on
Did
Sammy
you
Davis.
Really? You produced it?
Yeah.
That's Sammy Davis. Yeah. No, what did you think of Sammy Davis doing Shaft?
Well, I mean, I was thrilled, you know. I mean, you know, Sam and I were friends, and he wanted to do it, you know. And in fact, the night that we were in the studio doing that, it was the Golden Globe Awards. And I had no idea I would win, so Lou Gossett received the award in my stead. And I was in the studio with Sammy. Oh, wow.
It just seemed, you know, it's just really funny it's so out of character for him. I mean, he was going through this real kind of groovy period, I guess.
Yeah. You know Sammy, you know, he was into what was happening now, which is good. You know, he rolled with the trends.
Isaac Hayes recorded last year. We'll hear from action star Pam Grier after a break. This is Fresh Air. The queen of the blaxploitation films was Pam Grier. She was a sexy, tough-talking, two-fisted, sharp-shooting Avenger doing battle with pushers and pimps. Greer was an action hero years before women action heroes were common in mainstream films.
She's bad, she's beautiful, and she's back. She's Pam Greer, and when a woman's this hot, you can never get enough.
How about that?
Next is Coffee, a young nurse who's seen her 11-year-old sister destroyed by drugs. Now she wants to find out who's responsible and pay them all back. She turns into a one-woman hit squad on a trail of vengeance lined with hitmen, prostitutes, and thugs. It's Pam Greer in an explosive story of action, danger, and retribution.
All your friends are dead. Why kill them all?
Coffee. Then meet Friday Foster, ace photographer for Glance magazine.
She's just all woman.
Who becomes entangled in a web of political intrigue that takes her from the streets of New York to the corridors of power.
I want to talk with you about some of the blaxploitation films that you were in the beginning of your career. I know when I interviewed the filmmakers Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans, they both said that that those black action films were really important to them because it was the first time where there was a black hero and he got to get the girl at the end. He wasn't just the asexual sidekick. And I was wondering if you felt you had an equivalent effect for women watching the movies.
Oh, absolutely. Not only was it our images in front of the camera, we had craftsmen and technicians who got in the unions, which are now, which was very difficult to do, and now there are people who are within the business who can, you know, form production companies of their own and who have learned how to do films. So all around, it was very important on the technical side and the artistic side. For me, the films that I did, Coffee, Foxy Brown, and Sheba, were based on the women, the female characters in my family, who weren't very physical, but yet they were very strong women, but yet trying to maintain a sense of femininity. And my characters were based on my aunt, my mom, my grandmother, and some of the other women that lived in the neighborhood, that if, you know, they would protect their children with, you know, physical violence if they had to. And I guess for any woman, I think any woman would, whether she's strong or not.
Of course, they didn't go around shooting men in the groin like your
characters
did.
No, but I bet you they would if someone tried to attack them. I know where their knee would go if someone would try to steal their purse or hurt one of their children. I know exactly where their knee would go, or a broom or a brick or a skillet.
I think your first film was Black Mama, White Mama. Describe the part you played in that.
Well, it was a takeoff of a film that was done with Sidney Poitier and Tony Curtis, Terry, called The Defiant Ones, right? And, what was it? Yeah,
yeah,
The Defiant Ones.
Where they're handcuffed together,
right,
they're both
so
prisoners?
Right, so all of a sudden they did a female version of us escaping from a prison, defiantly trying to survive. So I guess, and it had a different title, Chains of Hate. Right, Chains of Hate. And they changed it to Black Mama, White Mama. You know, I'm sure that was to pull in the box office. And it was about two women escape from prison, chained together, and how they help each other. And my co-star, Margaret Markoff, was a ballerina.
Now, there became in your movies, I think, scenes you almost had to do in the films. I think it must have gotten to the point where you almost had to have a scene where you had a long, drawn-out series of fistfights with other women.
Yeah, I think that was some subtle, I don't know what you would call it on the air. I'm trying to find a better word for it. I don't know if it was on the part of the filmmaker or that they really like to see women be physical or do physical things or fight each other. I remember there were a lot of movies in the 50s where people really were excited to see women, you know, roll around the floor and fight. And I used to see it in my neighborhood, and I didn't like it. It used to bother me, you know, and it still bothers me. It's amazing because I have this strange contradiction. I have an aversion to violence, and I often look like Mary Poppins the way I dress, and I have that mentality. And then while I'll do a film, and it's the antithesis of how I really feel. I think the way I do a film, I see it, and it's something that my mother and my grandparents used to say to me, before you cast stones, walk a mile in someone's shoes. So I think the roles that I play are, I try to play someone who has that rage and violence and try to do it well. And I don't think it's something that I just want to do in my career from film after film or that I had to do. I think I was the only one that was really good at it. and made it look convincing.
Let me go back to some of your films from the 70s. You know, we were talking about how there was a fight with women in several of the films. There was also castration scenes where you'd shoot somebody or have another way.
Must have been a metaphor.
Well, how did these end up being an almost trademark in your film?
Well, I think it wasn't to be taken seriously. The scenes in the films weren't to be taken seriously. The castration was for people I think it was like a modern monster movie where you would see something so horrific and people would like, yeah, good thing. That's what the bad guy deserves. He was such a bad guy. And people who have different imaginations will see different things from it. And I think the only castration scene possibly was in this movie, Foxy Brown had one. And it was basically tongue-in-cheek and a bunch of metaphors. I never took it seriously.
Another thing is that in so many of your scenes, your clothes were draped in such a way and you were positioned in such a way as to be the sexiest. So tell me what it was like when they would be positioning you so that you'd be showing off, you know, more cleavage or whatever.
You can't really hide my cleavage. It's just there, unfortunately. I was one of those well-endowed children. And I think, you know, all of that was exploited to sell tickets on behalf of the filmmakers.
Did that bother you, or did you just get into it because you knew that there was a certain camp value in this
No,
also?
It was camp, but it was also an age where nudity in the 70s, we were still riding that wave of, you know, that free love and romping around Woodstock naked and our bodies are beautiful and why should I be ashamed of my body and that. And black women were never appreciated as that woman on the podium. She wasn't in advertising as much. She wasn't considered as beautiful. And black men didn't have these, you know, these black female sexy images to also feel good about their manhood. And I think that was an accumulation of why, you know, I draped and I was sultry and smoky and all those adjectives that they describe me as.
Pam Grier recorded in 1990. Her film Coffee is being shown this weekend at the Film Forum in New York as part of their series Blaxploitation, Baby.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right. A man that would risk his neck for his brother, man. Can you dig it? Who's the cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about? Right on. You see, this cat chef is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, Chef?
Then we can do it.
He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Shack.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Sons of the Blaxploitation Era. We talk with three filmmaker-actor comics, Keenan Ivory Wayans, Damon Wayans, and Robert Townsend. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Allies have issued a tough new warning to the Bosnian Serbs. Leave the safe haven of Garajda alone, or else. Foreign ministers of the Contact Group on Bosnia released their statement in London today. Defense Secretary William Perry summed up the Allies' decision.
We are not proposing to conduct an air campaign. We're proposing to threaten an air campaign to stop any action that the Bosnian Serbs might take to attack Garajda. Everybody at the meeting understands there would be substantial risks in doing that. To the air crews conducting the campaign, the risk would be involved to UN forces on the ground. The risk would be to even to civilians who are in the area of the targets. And the only reason we are going to proceed with that option is because the alternatives seemed even more unattractive to us.
The Allies have agreed that the United Nations must maintain its mission in Bosnia. Meanwhile, there are more reports of trouble in the Bosnian town of Zepa. Bosnian radio reports there's more shelling there. Serbian forces are outside the city. The United Nations is trying to beef up mediation efforts to allow the evacuation of all Muslims, including Bosnian government troops. Bosnian radio is also reporting potential trouble for Garajda. That city is facing possible mass hunger. A UN spokesman says food supplies are extremely scarce there. Today's scheduled landing of the space shuttle Discovery was postponed until tomorrow because of bad weather. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Both landing opportunities this morning at the Kennedy Space Center were scrubbed because of fog. Several decks of low-hanging clouds shrouded the Kennedy Space Center, and thick fog enveloped the shuttle's runway. Mission Control in Houston told the crew to remain in orbit for an extra day, with the landing now scheduled for Saturday morning, just before 6:30 Eastern Time. The crew is wrapping up an 8-day, now 9-day mission in orbit. The five astronauts deployed a communications satellite during their first day in space, then spent the remainder of their time conducting scientific research and biomedical experiments. The crew told NASA it doesn't mind spending an extra day in orbit one bit. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
A new spending cuts bill has cleared Congress. It took 5 months of debate. The initial version was vetoed by President Clinton, and Democrats vehemently opposed it. The new version passed today in the Senate by a vote of 90-7. It reduces existing programs by more than $16 billion. It also approves $7 billion in new spending for disaster relief. President Clinton says he'll sign it. On Wall Street, stock prices closed mixed today. The Dow ended the day unchanged at 4,641. Advances barely led declining issues in active trading. This is NPR. Fires raged out of control today in Greece, destroying extensive forest lands as well as several villages. Tasia Cavadias reports.
Officials say arson is the cause of the blaze stretching around the Mount Pendeli region east of Athens, the worst natural catastrophe in the area's history. Residents and authorities watched helplessly throughout the day as winds of up to 49 miles an hour grounded firefighting planes and fueled the blaze. Roaring flames and billowing smoke covered the area, about 25 miles long, leaving authorities unable to estimate just how extensive the damage is. In areas where power and phone lines were destroyed, church bells were sounded as a signal to evacuate. High winds are expected to continue, leaving little hope the fire can be controlled soon. For National Public Radio, I'm Tasia Cavadias in Athens.
Senator Barbara Boxer says she is not intimidated by Republicans who do not want public hearings on Senator Bob Packwood. The California Democrat said on the Senate floor today she'll introduce a resolution next week to require public ethics hearings on the conduct of the Oregon Republican. Boxer says the Senate loses the people's respect if it sweeps its problems under the committee room rug. Packwood is facing allegations that he made unwanted sexual advances to 17 women since 1969. He is also accused of altering personal diaries that he gave to investigators. A television station in Phoenix is reporting authorities have linked fertilizer, similar to the kind used in the Oklahoma City bombing, to two men associated with the Oklahoma bombing suspects. The station says James Rosencrans told investigators he dumped ammonium nitrate near Kingman, Arizona, at the request of his next-door neighbor, Michael Fortier. The report claims Fortier believed he was being watched by federal authorities. Fortier is an Army friend of bombing suspect Timothy McVeigh and is trying to negotiate a plea bargain in the case. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On the first part of this archive edition, we paid tribute to the blaxploitation films of the 70s. Keenan Ivory Wayans is one of today's African-American filmmakers who grew up on those action films. Before Wayans created the TV comedy series In Living Color, he paid tribute to the blaxploitation era with his satire, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. He wrote, directed, and starred in this comedy about a young man who returns home from the Army and learns his brother is dead.
Mom, exactly how did Junebug die? Mom.
She's really taking this pretty hard.
Well, is somebody gonna tell me what's going on?
Jack, not too long after you left, Junebug started hanging out with a bad crowd. I mean, he even started selling drugs, Jack. And then things really got bad when he...
Well, what?
He started wearing gold chains, Jack.
Oh, God, no.
It started out as just one or two. And it seemed like every time he'd get some money, he'd go and buy more gold chains. I mean, he was wearing hundreds of them, Jack, hundreds.
Not gold.
Yes, Jack, gold chains and medallions and rings and even his teeth, Jack. You can't imagine what it was like to kiss him. He took a picture just before he died. We put it on the mantle.
Junebug! How do you go to the bathroom with all this stuff on?
I spoke with Keenan Ivory Wayans in 1989 about his film I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
The basic story is about a character named Jack Spade, who is played by myself, who comes home from the Army after 10 years and finds out his brother's been killed from an overdose of gold chains. And he decides to do something about it, and he rounds up all of his old heroes, and they go after Mr. Big, who's a big gold distributor in town.
I thought of this as an homage as much as it was a parody. I figured you must have seen a lot of the black exploitation films.
It was exactly that. I lived on those movies. They were, and that was what we did on the weekends. We went down to the theaters with a couple of dollars and saw like three movies and spent the day. So I got a chance to see all those films in their heyday.
One of the retired heroes who gets back into the action after your character says, help me find Mr. Big. This character says, the people said I should retire, that I was too violent, that I was a bad image for the kids. Do you think that that's the rap that black exploitation films got, and do you think that that rap was deserved?
Well, that's the film that is the rap that they got. No, I don't think that it was the rap that they deserved. I think that the term became a blanket term, and it was used to describe almost every film that had a black cast. And what you have in any genre film is good and bad. An example is horror. You have Alfred Hitchcock, which is classic, and then you have Friday the 13th, Part 80, which is basically a formula picture that's slapped together with no real creative integrity designed to exploit an existing audience. And the same thing happened with films that depicted black life. They had the good ones and they had the bad ones. Shaft is not an exploitation movie. Shaft, as a matter of fact, was a monumental film. I mean, if you look at it, it was the first time a black man had been in a lead that displayed him with any aggression or any sexuality. Secondly, it was the first time that a black director had ever directed a major motion picture for a studio. That was Gordon Parks and MGM. It was also the first time that a black had ever won an Oscar for a score of a film, Isaac Hayes. So that was a great accomplishment. And when we look back, Shaft will be classified as an exploitation movie.
So you think in the attempt to get more positive role models, the opposite happened. There were no blacks on the screen for a long time.
Yeah, I think in the attempt to eliminate the negative, everybody overreacted, and as a result, abandoned the group of films that we had out there that represented us in a very good fashion.
Well, in your film, your character approaches all these former action heroes and brings them out of retirement. You literally did that to make the movie.
Yeah, to some degree,
You went to Isaac Hayes and to Jim Brown and to Bernie Casey and asked them to be in your movie. And I was wondering what kind of reactions you got from all of them, telling them that you were going to do this part parody, part homage to the movies that they were in.
Well, everybody who's in the film came on with the same enthusiasm about the movie that I had. They all thought it was funny and all looked at it as a chance to have fun making fun of themselves. there were those that I approached that didn't find it funny.
Your character is asked by one of these retired heroes what makes him think that he could be an action hero, and he says, I used to be a football player. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's a direct reference to Jim Brown who's in the movie. Do you think that was funny, or was he offended by it?
That was the line that made him want to do the movie.
Oh, great.
Yeah, because it epitomized the action films. The image of the black male at that particular time was the large, physically imposing, and very macho black men, and most of them were ex-football players, i.e. Jim Brown, Fred Williamson, Bernie Casey, Rosie Greer, Carl Weathers, you know, all came out of playing football. The transition was into being the action heroes.
When you were taking the screenplay around trying to get money to get it produced and everything, were there any suggestions that in order to really make back the money, you'd need to draw in a white audience, too? In order to get a white audience, there'd have to be more white characters or a white sidekick or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Well, one of the suggestions was to have Anthony Michael Hall play my stepbrother and have him act black the entire film. And my response was, I have 60 real black people in the movie. Why have him in there acting black, you know?
Keenan Ivory Wayans will hear from his younger brother Damon after this break. This is Fresh Air. Shortly after I spoke with Keenan Ivory Wayans in 1989, I interviewed his younger brother Damon, who is featured in Keenan's film I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker. Damon hoped to follow in his brother's footsteps and direct and star in his own films, which he's since succeeded in doing. Damon Wayans joined us on Fresh Air before he became a star through the TV comedy series In Living Color. When we spoke, HBO was about to show his first solo comedy special.
You do a lot of character sketches. Like the guy who does heroin and cocaine just before coming to your apartment to meet your parents and pick up your sister on a date.
Yeah, that's kind of true.
Is that based on something that happened or someone you know?
Yeah, I built the story because he actually was so high that he told my mother he sees where my sister gets her big behind from, and he thought he was complimenting her. And so I found that very funny.
How old were you when that happened, and where were you watching from?
In the living room, and I was there, and it's just, you know, I was the kid who was very quiet and shy, but I watched everything, and nothing escaped my eye. So after the person left my house, I would do my own impression of them.
Oh, hey, what's happening, daddy-o? Say, I'm here to pick your daughter up. Yeah, Deidre. Oh, I'm taking her to the movies, man. Oh, we gonna go see Caligula. Say, this is a nice place you got here, Mr. Wayne. This is all right for the projects. I especially like this color TV you got here. Let me ask you something. About how much do that weigh? Look, now I know that this is your daughter. See, I understand that father-daughter relationship. I got 5 kids of my own.
You grew up in a housing project. Do you still have family there? Do you go back there at all?
Yeah, my brother just, with the success of Sucker, he bought my mom a house in New Rochelle. So she's in her world now. You know, she's got her own house, and it's 4-bedroom. And, you know, she used to need 4 bedrooms. Now it's just her and my father. And they just walk around looking at the rooms, talk about how they're going decorate them for my kids and my my sister's kids and stuff. So I do go back. I was just back in New York, and I saw my friends. And, you know, I try and stay in touch with the people I grew up with. I think it's important.
Are they surprised that you're in comedy? Did you have a reputation for being funny when you were younger?
Yeah. But, you know, it's just, I think I defied the odds. I wasn't, the trouble that I got into as a kid, I shouldn't be where I'm at right now. I really shouldn't.
What kind of trouble?
Just trying to be, you know, one of the guys. It's all socioeconomic. There wasn't much to do. They closed all the community centers, so we invented our own games, like take the money and run. And we did things for fun that weren't fun, that were against the law. So those kind of things.
I remember when your brother Keenan was on our program, he was saying that he used to think of your mother as being kind of omniscient, that she always knew what the kids were up to.
Yeah, that's the scary thing. It's like I have friends who would like be able to bring home a whole stereo system and tell their mother they found it, a brand new stereo system. I couldn't do that in my house. You know, my parents were hip, and they knew. My father sat me down one day and told me he knew what I was doing, and if I ever got in trouble, don't call home because he's not coming to get me. You know, whereas, you know, my friends, I think they had a deal with their parents to give them a commission or something.
You've been in several movies recently. You were in Colors, Punchline. I think you were in Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, that was my first job.
Uh-huh, and I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Mm-hmm.
Have you been finding it hard or relatively easy to find good black roles in films?
First of all, when you say a black, that's the problem with Hollywood, is the black roles.
Yeah.
Very limited with black roles. And when they think black, automatically it's stereotyped. And those aren't the roles that I want to do. I mean, I enjoy doing a street character, but I'll never win an Oscar for doing a street character because they think that's what I am anyway, you know? So I want to do something which is a stretch to me and a stretch to America, you know? And I think I'll have to write that myself.
I think you've said that white writers have a hard time writing convincing parts for black actors.
Yeah, that's because they label it black. And then a black guy comes in, and then they put in their mind, you know, what a black guy is, and it's, hey, man, yo, you ain't behaving, happening, you know, and it's, and you read it, and it just makes you nauseous. When I don't mind someone writing a role, and then they say, okay, now you bring the blackness to it, see? That's cool, but when they write it black, then it's not for me.
Damon Wayans, recorded in 1989.
I'm gonna get you, sucker. Dirty mother.
Don't say that.
I'm gonna teach you the crime. Just don't pay. I'm gonna get you, sucker. Dirty mother.
Hold on, brother.
I'm gonna stay on your case till I put you away. Know your face that life's a bowl of cherries, and you can absolutely do no wrong. A big brother. A word from the wise shall be sufficient. So I suggest you pay close attention to the words to this song. Woo!
Gold fever.
We'll hear from Robert Townsend in a minute. This is Fresh Air. The Allies met in London today to figure out what to do in Bosnia. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
Sylvia Poggioli is covering the story in London, Terry. She says that the statement that comes out of that meeting is that there will be substantial and decisive action taken if the Bosnians move on Garajda.
So, of course, there's a lot of debate about what exactly substantial and decisive might mean. Tom Jelton will analyze the position for us. We also are watching the Americans and others taken hostage in Kashmir. We'll have a report on OJ, on Waco, on the good old boys thing, and on the affirmative action decision in California.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Many African-American actors have had a hard time finding roles other than pimps, addicts, and street punks. Actor, director, and comic Robert Townsend satirized how the film industry treats black actors in his film Hollywood Shuffle.
We're looking for charisma. We're looking for sex appeal and yet innocence. We're looking for that certain je ne sais quoi. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think so.
With that in mind, Richard, I want you to start reading from the top of the page. And I want you to give it to us, but really give it to us.
Relax.
And relax, but I need some tension at the same time. But not too relaxed, but don't forget to give me sparkle.
Can I start?
Oh, please, please, anytime you're ready.
This is Jimmy, man! Jimmy! And when my game flies out, you'll be dead!
Time out, Richie.
Anyway, after getting my degree from the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, I decided to come to Hollywood and do some movies.
Good. Why don't you start with the speech? That's very interesting.
Sure. Okay. Let me see. What it is, bro, I ain't afraid of you. What is happening with your cool vines?
Thank you. Thank you. That's
You're the worst actor I've ever seen in my life. I have to be frank with you.
I could do it in iambic.
I ain't be got no weapon. Why you be gotta pull a knife on me? I be shot.
Wonderful.
I spoke with Robert Townsend about Hollywood Shuffle in 1987, when his memories of auditioning for the stock black male roles were still very fresh.
I didn't know how to speak up at that point because every actor in town was in there auditioning, and I said, wait, this is a terrible script. Maybe it's me. And then I started thinking about it, and I would go in and read a script, and I go, this is terrible. And then the next guy, this is the greatest pimp I've ever read, you know. And I think it had to do with, you know, I began back then to begin to look and see something was wrong.
What kind of roles were you auditioning for that you're talking about?
Stoolies on TV shows, you know, the guys that always have the information that the cops always talk to. Huggy Bear, Turkey Neck, you know, they always have those weird names. So those are the kind of parts I would audition for.
Are you convincing in that kind of role?
I'm a good actor. I could pull it off, yeah. I mean, I consider myself a good actor. You know, I wouldn't mind doing a street character if I could play a lawyer next week and a doctor the week after that, or a detective like Sam Ace or something like that.
But the problem is there aren't many roles like that to play.
Right. They always write the stereotypical, you know, just jive street.
The character in your movie is directed to be blacker while he's playing a part or auditioning for a part. Were you ever directed to be more black?
Oh, yeah, because, see, the way I talk, when you're considered black, you're supposed to talk like, well, yeah, baby, you know, I'm doing this interview and things with you. So that's the way I should talk. That's considered black. If I was saying like, oh, this is national radio, baby. That's black. But the way I'm talking now, then they say, well, you don't sound black. I mean, you could, you know, if I was just tuning in, I would say, is this a black person? I don't give you the key words. And so a lot of times they ask you to be blacker because black is, you know, all the, you know, sitcoms of the 70s. And they say what? So that's considered black.
Now, you've also been in some TV commercials. For years, there were virtually no black actors in TV commercials, but now, especially in burger commercials and in soft drink commercials, there's a lot of black actors in it. Are there new stereotypes of blacks coming out through these commercials?
No, I think commercials, if anything, they show black people in a better light. I mean, in TV commercials, at least I had dignity in 60 seconds. I mean, I was a bank teller, I was a construction worker. I was a plumber. Just a regular guy hanging out at an office building, you know, waiting on a date. I mean, they have different, you know, commercials at least show life. You'll see a black family on a TV commercial. On TV shows, you never see that. You know, you'll see, like for McDonald's, you'll see, it's time to go, our family's on our way to McDonald's. Hey, Dad, you know, and they'll show like a Loving Family or Tide commercial. They, you know, show a family with a mother and father. Your average show on TV, it's always, I had to raise these kids on my own, and I'd never seen they daddy.
What are some of the movies you liked when you were growing up?
Wizard of Oz. My favorite film of all time is Here Comes Mr. Jordan with Robert Montgomery. That was one of my favorite films.
I love that film. That's the film about the boxer who's been reincarnated, basically, sent back
right.
down to Earth.
Yeah, Claude Rains, Robert Montgomery, and Warren Beatty did the updated version with Buck Henry and James Mason. It's like, Joe, listen, Joe, you're not Pendleton, Joe. You can't stay in this body, Joe. You know, that was one of my favorite films.
As a teenager, did you like any of the exploitation films like Shaft and Superfly?
I love those movies because that was the first time we saw the black man get the girl. You know, I remember seeing the scene in Superfly when he made love in the bathtub, and it was like, I can't believe this. Because other than that, black people had played butlers, and it's like, you want your luggage, Mr. Jenkins? And that was the only role we played. And so when you saw Shaft, and he had a gun, and he slapped people around, and he fought for right, you know, it was like, great. We had never seen it. Because normally, the black actor was the buddy to the star. He never, you know, like, he never was the man. You know, he never was in charge and said, I'm fighting for right. And that's what I'm going to do here. You guys are bad, you know. And Shaft was that way, and Superfly was that way. I just think that they made more pimp movies than they made movies about, you know, black people from the regular walks of life. I think that's what messed everything up. There were too many negative role models. I mean, if they would have had a pimp movie and then a movie about a doctor, then a movie about a lawyer, and a movie about a guy who was in love, everything would have been fine. But it was just, you know, 90 pimp movies versus one sounder. You know, that was what the deal was.
Robert Townsend recorded in 1987. He now stars in the TV series The Parenthood. More interviews from our archives next week at this time. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced with Nancy Greenlee's Kathy Wolf and Roberta Shurrock, who directs the show. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.